help them. I just smile, geisha-like, and make little fluttery sounds of understanding. Then I go on telling people to consider finding someone who would not mind reading their drafts and marking them up with useful suggestions. The person may not have an answer to what is missing or annoying about the piece, but writing is so often about making mistakes and feeling lost. There are probably a number of ways to tell your story right, and someone else may be able to tell you whether or not you've found one of these ways. I'm not suggesting that you and another writer sit in a cubby somewhere and write together, as though you were doing potato prints side by side at the institution, and that then you beam at each other's work the way you gape when your kid first writes his name. But I am suggesting that there may be someone out there in the world, maybe a spouse, maybe a close friend, who will read your finished drafts and give you an honest critique. Let you know what does and doesn't work, give you some suggestions on things you might take out or things on which you need to elaborate. Ways in which to make your piece stronger. In the first story of Donald Bartlemy's I ever read, 20 years ago, he said that truth is a hard apple to catch, and it is a hard apple to throw. I know what a painful feeling it is when you've been working on something forever and it feels done, and you give your story to someone you hope will validate this, and that person tells you it still needs more work. You have to, at this point, question your assessment of this person's character, and, if he or she is not a spouse or a lifelong friend, decide whether or not you want them in your life at all. Mostly, I think an appropriate first reaction is to think that you don't. But in a little while, it may strike you as a small miracle that you have someone in your life whose taste you admire. After all, this person loves you and your work. Who will tell you the truth and help you stay on the straight and narrow, or find your way back to it if you're lost. I always show my work to one of two people before sending a copy to my editor or agent. I feel more secure and connected this way, and these two people get a lot of good work out of me. They're like midwives. There are these stories and ideas and visions and memories and plots inside me, and only I can give birth to them. Theoretically, I could do it alone, but it sure makes it easier to have people helping. I have girlfriends who had their babies through natural childbirth, no drugs, no spinal, no nothing, and they secretly think they had a more honest birth experience, but I think the epidural is right up there with the most important breakthroughs in the West. Like the Salk polio vaccine in salad bars and supermarkets. It's an individual thing. What works for me may not work for you. But feedback from someone I'm close to gives me confidence. Or at least it gives me time to improve. Imagine that you are getting ready for a party, and there is a person at your house who can check you out and assure you that you look wonderful, or conversely, that you actually do look a little tiny, tiny bit heavier than usual in this one particular dress or suit, or that red makes you look just a bit like you have sarcoptic mange. Of course, you're disappointed for a moment, but then you are grateful that you are still in the privacy of your own home and there is time to change. One of the best writers I know has a wife who reads everything he writes and tells him when she loves it and when she doesn't, why it does or doesn't work for her. She is almost like an equal partner in the process. Two other writers I know use each other. As I said, I have two people who read my stuff. One is another writer, who is one of my best friends and probably the most neurotic, mentally ill person in my galaxy. Another is a librarian who reads two or three books a week, but has never written a word. What I do is to work over a piece until it feels just about right, and then I send it to one of these two friends, who have agreed in advance to read it. I always send my work Federal Express because I'm too impatient to wait for the mail to deliver it. I spend the entire next day waiting to hear, pacing, overeating, feeling paranoid and badly treated if I haven't heard from my friends by noon. Naturally, I assume that they think it is tripe, but that they don't have the courage to tell me. Then I'll think about all the things I don't like about either of them, how much, in fact, I hate both of them, how it is no wonder that neither of them has many friends. And then the phone will ring, and they usually say something along the lines of, I think it's going to be great. I think it's really good work, but I also think there are a few problems. At this point, I'm usually open to suggestion because I'm so relieved that they think it's going to be great. And I ask gaily where they think there's room for improvement. This is where things can get ever so slightly dicey. They might say that the whole first half is slow, and they couldn't get into it, but that on page 6 or 38 or whatever, things finally got going, and then they couldn't put it down. They absolutely raced through the rest of it, except that maybe they had a bit of trouble with the ending, and they wonder if I really understand one character's motivation and whether I might just want to spend, 5 minutes, no more, rethinking this person. My first response, if they have a lot of suggestions, is never profound relief that I have someone in my life who will be honest with me and help me do the very best work of which I'm capable. No, my first thought is, well, I'm sorry, but I can't be friends with you anymore because you have too many problems, and you have a bad personality, and a bad character. Sometimes I can't get words to come out of my mouth because I'm so disappointed, as if they had said that Sam is ugly and boring and spoiled and I should let him go. Criticism is very hard to take. But then, whichever friend is savaging my work will suggest that we go through it together page by page, line by line, and in a clipped, high-pitched voice, I'll often suggest that this won't be necessary, that everything's just fine. But these friends usually talk me into going through the manuscript with them over the phone, and if I'll hang in there, they'll have found a number of places where things could be so much stronger, or funnier, or more real, or more interesting, or less tedious. They may even have ideas on how to fix those places, and so, by the end, I am breathing a great sigh of relief, and even gratitude. When someone reliable gives you this kind of feedback, you now have some true sense of your work's effect on people, and you may now know how to approach your final draft. If you're getting ready to send your work to a potential agent for the first time, you don't want to risk burning that bridge by sending something that's just not ready. You really must get your piece or book just right as you can. Sometimes it's just a matter of fine-tuning, or maybe one whole character needs to be rethought. Sometimes the friend will love the feel of the writing, the raw material, and yet feel that it's a million miles from being done. This can be deeply disappointing, but again, better that your spouse or friend tell you this than an agent or an editor. I heard Marianne Williamson say once that when you ask God into your life, you think he or she is going to come into your psychic house, look around, and see that you just need a new floor or better furniture and that everything needs just a little cleaning, and so you go along for the first 6 months thinking how nice life is now that God is there. Then you look out the window one day and see that there's a wrecking ball outside. It turns out that God actually thinks your whole foundation is shot and you're going to have to start over from scratch. This is exactly what it can be like to give, say, a novel to someone else to read. This person can love it and still find it a total mess, in need of a great deal of work, of even a new foundation. So how do I find one of these partners, my students ask. The same way you find a number of people for a writing group. The only difference is that in this case, you're looking for one partner instead of several. So if you're in a class, look around. See if there's someone whose work you've admired who seems to be at about the same level as you. Then you can ask him or her if he or she wants to meet for a cup of coffee and see if you can work with each other. It's like asking for a date, so while you're doing this, you'll probably be rolfed by all your most heinous memories of 7th and 8th grade. If the person says no, it's good to wait until you get inside your car before you fall apart completely. Then you can rend your clothes and keen and do a primal scream. Of course, you probably want to be sure that the person hasn't followed you out to your car, but it actually doesn't matter if he or she sees you break down because you don't have to be friendly with that person anymore. That person is a jerk. You double up therapy sessions for a few weeks until you're back in the saddle, and then you ask someone else, someone you like much better. If you know for sure that some smart and civilized person loves your work, You can ask that person if she would be willing to look at a part of your novel or your latest short story. If this person writes, too, ask if she would like you to take a look at her draft. If she says no to both offers, pretend to be friendly so she won't think less of you than she already does. Then you can move into a trailer park near your therapist's house until you're well enough again to ask someone else. The second question my students ask about a writing partner is this. What if someone agrees to read and work on your stuff for you, and you've agreed to do the same for him, say, and it turns out that he says things about your work, even in the nicest possible tone of voice, that are totally negative and destructive? You find yourself devastated, betrayed. Here, you've done this incredibly gutsy thing, shown someone your very heart and soul, and he doesn't think it's any good. He says how sorry he is that this is how he feels. Well, let me tell you this. I don't think he is. I think destroying your work gave him real pleasure, pleasure he would never cop to, pleasure that is almost sexual in nature. I think you should get rid of this person immediately, even if you're married to him. No one should talk to you like this. If you write a long piece, and it is your first, and you're wondering if it's publishable, and it isn't, even by a long shot, someone should be able to tell you this in a way that is gentle yet not patronizing, so that you're encouraged. Maybe not to pursue publication, but to pursue writing. Certainly this person might suggest you get a second opinion. But if he is too strident or adamant, ditch the sucker. Would you stand for someone talking this way to your children? For instance, telling them that they are not very talented at painting and shouldn't even bother? Or that their poetry is not very interesting? Of course not. You'd want to go pay this person a little visit with your flamethrower. So why, if someone says something like this to you, would you want anything further to do with him? Why waste what little time you may have left with such scum? I worry that Jesus drinks himself to sleep when he hears me talk like this. But about a month before my friend Pammy died, she said something that may have permanently changed me. We'd gone shopping for a dress for me to wear that night to a nightclub with the man I was seeing at the time. Pammy was in a wheelchair wearing her Queen Mum wig, the Easy Rider look in her eyes. I tried on a lavender mini dress, which is not my usual style. I tend to wear big, baggy clothes. People used to tell me I dressed like John Goodman. Anyway, the dress fit perfectly, and I came out to model it for her. I stood there feeling very shy and self-conscious and pleased. Then I said, "Do you think it makes my hips look too big?" And she said to me slowly, "Annie, I really don't think you have that kind of time. And I don't think you have that kind of time either. I don't think you have time to waste not writing because you're afraid you won't be good enough at it. And I don't think you have time to waste on someone who does not respond to you with kindness and respect. You don't want to spend your time around people who make you hold your breath. You can't fill up when you're holding your breath. And writing is about filling up when you're empty, letting images and ideas and smells run down like water. Just as writing is also about dealing with the emptiness. The emptiness destroys enough writers without the help of some friend or spouse. There are always a couple of rank beginners in my classes, and they need people to read their drafts who will rise to the occasion with respect and encouragement. Beginners always try to fit their whole lives into 10 pages, and they always write blatantly about themselves, even if they make the heroine of their piece a championship racehorse with an alcoholic mother who cries a lot. But beginners are learning to play, and they need encouragement to keep their hands moving across the page. If you look around, I think you will find the person you need. Almost every writer I've ever known has been able to find someone who could be both a friend and a critic. You'll know when the person is right for you and when you are right for that person. It's not unlike finding a mate, where little by little you begin to feel that you've stepped into a shape that was waiting there all along. Letters. When you don't know what else to do, when you're really stuck and filled with despair and self-loathing and boredom, but you can't just leave your work alone for a while and wait, you might try telling part of your history, part of a character's history, in the form of a letter. The letter's informality just might free you from the tyranny of perfectionism. You might address the letter to your children, if you have a few lying around, or to a niece or nephew, or to a friend. Write that person's name at the top of the page, and then in your first line, explain that you're going to tell them part of your story. Entrust it to them, because this part of your life meant so much to you. Some of the best pieces to come out of my classes have been written by people who wanted to tell their children about their childhoods, or about their children's childhoods, what the years were like just before these children were born and then after, in that first house the family lived in, down the hill from the little white church, or about those years in the Peace Corps in that tiny, wild, brilliant African village, or what it was like to work on a whaling ship in the 40s. A man in one of my classes, who was raised in a family of foot-washing Baptists, wrote a 200-page letter to his children about his childhood in the South, how he escaped, and his years on an Alaskan whaler, where he found God and, later, in port, their mother. A woman in a class many years ago wrote a novella-length letter to her daughter about life as a Chinese-American nurse living in Sao Paulo. It included everything she could remember, having seen and felt and thought. She read part of it to our class. It was just beautiful, intimate, funny in places, and sad. People cried. Then she used it as a plot treatment for a novel. A magazine editor recently asked me to write an essay about being a lifelong Giants fan, which I have been, but the anxiety about publication made my mind go suddenly blank. All I could remember at first was coming into the kitchen of the little coffee-colored house where I grew up to find my mother and older brother hunched over the radio, listening to a Giants game with such concentration that it might have been the first news reports from Pearl Harbor. I started wanting to be able to tell Sam my stories about being a fan, because I didn't want that aspect of my life to be lost. But when I began, that one image was really all I could remember. So I started to talk to other fans about what they remembered, and it all started coming back. The whole huge, bright green overlit space that is Candlestick Park. How going there was like stepping into Oz. It was like discovering Greenland. I remembered worrying that it would surely take 20 players to cover all that land, and yet there were only 3. Dear Sam, I wrote at the top of the page, I want to tell you about how I loved the San Francisco Giants when I was a little kid. Instead of imagining the editor peering skeptically over my shoulder as I wrote, I pictured Sam sitting down to read this one day. How glad he might be that I had gotten it down. I started telling him my memories of the strangely reddish dirt of the base paths, the gunfire of batting practice, the feel of being part of a healthy mob, part of a pulse, part of a collective heartbeat. I called friends and compared notes about what it felt like to be a part of a huge struggle where people were winning and losing and triumphing and being humiliated, and for once it wasn't you. Then I told Sam about this, on paper. I talked to people who remembered what it felt like to watch Juan Marichal's impossibly high kick and Willie McCovey, the best hitter a lot of us ever saw, and Gaylord Perry with his sneaky little spitballs, so mean and snarly and sweaty that he looked like he came right out of the red dirt country of Georgia. And then I remembered the very first time I saw Willie Mays in center field. How it was like seeing Jesus out there. I was 5 years old. Someone in one of my phone calls mentioned Tito Fuentes, and it all came back, how much I loved him and felt that one day we might marry, and how I loved to cry out his name along with everyone else, Tito, Tito, and how it made me feel like someone from West Side Story. Little by little, in telling Sam all these details, I got to see the bigger point of baseball. That it can give us back ourselves. We're a crowd animal, a highly gregarious, communicative species, but the culture and the age and all the fear that fills our days have put almost everyone into little boxes, each of us all alone. But baseball,
If we love it, gives us back our place in the crowd. It restores us. So, I wrote all this down in my letter to Sam. And little by little, memory and detail and fact and feeling wove themselves together. Like a Polaroid, the letter emerged. And from it, the essay. Clear and bright, full of smells and sounds and full of hope. Because baseball, like life, throbs with hope. Or it wouldn't exist. And full of me. For Sam and his children to read one day. Writer's block. There are few experiences as depressing as that anxious, barren state known as writer's block, where you sit staring at your blank page like a cadaver, feeling your mind congeal, feeling your talent run down your leg and into your sock. Or you look at the notes you scribbled recently on yellow legal pads or index cards and they look like something Richard Speck jotted down the other night. And at the same time, as it turns out, you happen to know that your closest writing friend is on a roll, has been turning out stories and screenplays and children's books and even most of a novel, like he or she is some crazy potholder factory, potholders pouring out the windows because there is simply not enough room inside for such glorious productivity. Writer's block is going to happen to you. You will read what little you've written lately and see with absolute clarity that it is total dog shit. A blissfully productive manic stage may come to a screeching halt, and all of a sudden you realize you're Wile E. Coyote, and you run off the cliff and are a second away from having to look down. Or else you haven't been able to write anything at all for a while. The fear that you'll never write again is going to hit you when you feel not only lost and unable to find a few little breadcrumbs that would identify the path you were on, but also when you're at your lowest ebb of energy and faith. You may feel a little as if writing a novel is like trying to level Mount McKinley with a dentist drill. Things feel hopeless, or at least bleak, and you're not imaginative or organized enough to bash your way through to a better view, let alone some interesting conclusion. You know where every idea, quote, and image came from. None of them is fresh. You're so familiar with what you're saying that your words all sound utterly commonplace. Writers are like vacuum cleaners, sucking up all that we can see and hear and read and think and feel and articulate, and everything that everyone else within earshot can hear and see and think and feel. We're mimics, we're parrots, we're writers, but knowing the source of all our stuff deprives it of its magic, because then the material feels mundane, cliched. You didn't have to discover it because it was already there for all to see. You may start to feel that you're trying to pass off a TV dinner as home cooking. We have all been there, and it feels like the end of the world. It's like a little chickadee being hit by an H-bomb. Here's the thing, though. I no longer think of it as block. I think that is looking at the problem from the wrong angle. If your wife locks you out of the house, you don't have a problem with your door. The word block suggests that you are constipated or stuck, when the truth is that you're empty. As I said in the last chapter, this emptiness can destroy some writers, as do the shame and frustration that go with it. You feel that the writing gods gave you just so many good days, maybe even enough of them to write one good book and then part of another. But now you're having some days or weeks of emptiness. As if suddenly the writing gods are saying, enough, don't bother me, I have given to you until it hurts, please, I've got problems of my own. The problem is acceptance, which is something we're taught not to do. We're taught to improve uncomfortable situations, to change things, alleviate unpleasant feelings. But if you accept the reality that you've been given, that you are not in a productive creative period, you free yourself to begin filling up again. I encourage my students at times like these to get one page of anything written, 300 words of memories or dreams or stream of consciousness on how much they hate writing, just for the hell of it, just to keep their fingers from becoming too arthritic, just because they have made a commitment to try to write 300 words every day. Then, on bad days and weeks, Let things go at that. I remind myself nearly every day of something that a doctor told me 6 months before my friend Pammy died. This was a doctor who always gave me straight answers. When I called on this one particular night, I was hoping she could put a positive slant on some distressing developments. She couldn't, but she said something that changed my life. "Watch her carefully right now," she said, "because she's teaching you how to live." I remind myself of this when I cannot get any work done. To live as if I am dying, because the truth is, we are all terminal on this bus. To live as if we are dying gives us a chance to experience some real presence. Time is so full for people who are dying in a conscious way. Full in the way that life is for children. They spend big, round hours. So instead of staring miserably at the computer screen trying to will my way into having a breakthrough, I say to myself, okay, let's see, dying tomorrow. What should I do today? Then I can decide to read Wallace Stevens for the rest of the morning, or go to the beach, or just really participate in ordinary life. Any of these will begin the process of filling me back up with observations, flavors, ideas, visions, memories. I might want to write on my last day on Earth, but I'd also be aware of other options that would feel at least as pressing. I would want to keep whatever I did simple, I think. And I would want to be present. In the beginning, when you're first starting out, there are a million reasons not to write, to give up. That is why it is of extreme importance to make a commitment to finish sections and stories, to driving through to the finish. The discouraging voices will hound you. "This is all piffle," they will say, and they might be right. What you're doing may just be practice. But this is how you're going to get better. And there is no point in practicing if you don't finish. I went through a real crisis of faith about two-thirds of the way through my last novel. The thing is that I had gotten 27 bad reviews in a row on my previous novel, and I was feeling just the merest bit unsure about my skills and the joys of publication. But during that crisis of faith, I made a commitment to the characters in the new novel instead of to the book itself. So I spent a little time at my desk every day, just writing down memories of my family, my youth. I went for walks and to a lot of matinees, and I read. I spent as much time as I could outdoors while I waited for my unconscious to open a door and beckon. It finally did. I did not have some beautiful Hallmark moment when I threw back my shoulders with a big smile, dusted off my old hands, and got back to work. Rather, it was like catching amoebic dysentery. I was just sitting there minding my business, and then the next minute I rushed to my desk with an urgency I had not believed possible. It helps to resign as the controller of your fate. All that energy we expend to keep things running right is not what's keeping things running right. We're bugs struggling in the river, brightly visible to the trout below. With that fact in mind, people like me make up all these rules to give us the illusion that we're in charge. I need to say to myself, they're not needed, hun. Just take in the buggy pleasures. Be kind to the others, grab the flecks of river weed. Notice how beautifully your bug legs scull. All the good stories are out there, waiting to be told in a fresh, wild way. Mark Twain said that Adam was the only man who, when he said a good thing, knew that nobody had said it before. Life is like a recycling center, where all the concerns and dramas of humankind get recycled back and forth across the universe. But what you have to offer is your own sensibility, maybe your own sense of humor, or insider pathos, or meaning. All of us can sing the same song, and there will still be 4 billion different renditions. Some people will sing it spontaneously with a lot of soulful riffs, while others are going to practice until they could sing it at the Met. Either way, everything we need in order to tell our stories in a reasonable and exciting way already exists in each of us. Everything you need is in your head, and memories, in all that your senses provide, in all that you've seen and thought and absorbed, there in your unconscious. Where the real creation goes on is the little kid or the Dr. Seuss creature in the cellar, arranging and stitching things together. When this being is ready to hand things up to you, to give you a paragraph or a sudden move one character makes that will change the whole course of your novel, you will be entrusted with it. So, in the meantime, while the tailor is working, you might as well go get some fresh air. Do your 300 words and then go for a walk. Otherwise, you'll want to sit there and try to contribute, and this will only get in the way. Your unconscious can't work when you're breathing down its neck. You'll sit there going, "Are you done in there yet? Are you done in there yet?" But it is trying to tell you nicely, "Shut up and go away." Part 4. Publication and other reasons to write. Writing a present. Publication is not going to change your life or solve your problems. Publication will not make you more confident or more beautiful, and it will probably not make you any richer. There will be a very long build-up to publication day, and then the festivities will usually be over rather quickly. We will talk about all of this at great length shortly. In the meantime, let's discuss some of the other reasons to write that may surprise a writer, even a writer who hasn't given up on getting published. There are arenas full of potential for rich reward, where your life and your sense of self and of abundance really can be changed. All of a sudden, I cannot remember if we are allowed to use the word abundance in California anymore. I will have to get back to you on this. Twice now, I have written books that began as presents to people I loved who were going to die. I've told you a little about my father's diagnosis of brain cancer, how all of a sudden I had a sad story to tell. It was a story rich with drama and humor about a father and his three semi-grown children living in a tiny town filled with aging hippies, trust fund radicals, artists, New Agers, and ordinary people, whatever that means. Out of nowhere, the rug was suddenly pulled out from under the family, when it looked as if the father had a terminal illness and was actually going to go ahead and die. So I started writing about our new life. I recorded moments of my brothers trying to help our father, trying to help one another, all of us trying to keep our senses of humor, trying to find meaning in it all, and saying what was really on our minds. There were lots of descriptions of the townspeople and the landscape that I'd already written that I still liked and could use, but the best stuff was what my father and brothers were going through right then, right at that moment. I scribbled down the funny things they said, the tender moments, the black humor, the weirdness of it all. Then I started shaping that material into self-contained stories. I showed them to my father, who thought it was great that all this pain and fear and loss were being transformed into a story of love and survival. He would hand me back my pages, raise his fist in the black power salute, and smile. This was enough to keep me going. In a sense, I was giving him a love letter. He never got his version of the story written. But the miracle was that I finished mine while his brain was still working. He got to read the whole thing. He got to know that he and his story were going to exist long after he took off his dog suit and went to the great beyond. Another propellant for this first novel of mine was that I found myself desperate for books that talked about cancer in a way that would both illuminate the experience and make me laugh. But there weren't very many. In fact, there was only one that I was aware of, Violet Weingarten's Intimations of Mortality, a journal of her chemotherapy from which I got my book's epigram. Is life too short to be taking shit, or is life too short to be minding it? I read the book over and over, read it out loud to my brothers over the phone, then went to the library and said, "Do you have any other really funny books about cancer?" And they looked at me like, "Yeah, they're right over there by the comedies about spina bifida." There didn't seem to be any. A book about our experience, showing one family's attempt to stay buoyant in the face of such a potentially flattening process, seemed like it might be a welcome present to other people with sick relatives. This is all I tried to do, to tell our family story, because with an enormous amount of support from friends, there were laughter and joy folded into all that fear and loss. It helped my father have the best possible months before his death, and the best possible death. I can actually say that it was great. Hard and fucked six ways from Sunday, but great. Of course, not everyone loved my book. There were some terrible reviews. My personal favorite was from a newspaper in Santa Barbara, which said that our black sense of humor made us look like a New Age Addams Family. "Here's your review from Santa Barbara," my editor wrote on a note enclosed with it, "where people never die." 15 years later, my friend Pammy was diagnosed with breast cancer. I had been keeping a journal about my new son, whom she was helping me raise, so most of the journal entries already included her. And now, all of a sudden, it turned out that she was not going to be around for much longer. So I started typing up the journal entries and sending them off to my agent. Sam was getting bigger and Pammy was getting sicker, and I was writing as fast as I could, trying to get it done in time for her to read it. And I did. I gave her a finished copy 4 months before she died. It was another love letter. Mostly to her and Sam. And for her daughter, Rebecca. Pammy knew there was something that was going to exist on paper after she was gone. Something that was going to be, in a certain way, part of her immortality. Again, there was a part of me that believed that my journal could be a gift for others. For single mothers. I couldn't find any books about single parenting when Sam was first born that were funny and sick and therefore true. There were some great books on child rearing, but none that made me laugh and none that went into the dark side. The Seventh Seal with Milky Bra's part. They were all so nicey-nice and rational and suggested that surely if you did this or that, the colicky little darling would come around, pull himself or herself together, get a grip. And this simply wasn't true. Having a baby is like suddenly getting the world's worst roommate, like having Janis Joplin with a bad hangover and PMS come to stay with you. All the available baby books recommended things like white noise to soothe the yowling little savant. So I'd sit there by Sam's side and play him Sierra Club tapes of rivers at night, complete with crickets and owls and frogs. And he'd look over, worriedly, for a moment, like, "Are you out of your mind? Why don't you just play me a tape of shark fights?" And then he would really start to cry. I would have felt so relieved if there had been a book written by another mother who admitted that she sometimes wanted to grab her infant by the ankles and swing him over her head like a bolo. So I went ahead and started writing one myself, as a present, as a kind of roadmap for other mothers. I would have been so relieved, too, if after Pammy got sick when Sam was 8 months old, there had been a book about losing your best friend that was real, but also funny. So I ended up trying to write one, weaving together these two stories of Sam and Pammy. For both of them and for anyone who might know anyone like either of them. A couple of years later, a few months after Pammy died, two close friends of ours had a baby who was born so damaged that he died at 5 months old. I began to wonder if I was some sort of carrier. Sam and I spent a lot of time with the parents and their little son. They did such an amazing job and taught me so much, and their son taught me so much that I wanted other people to know about it. I wanted to write about it as a present for the parents, so that this baby would keep on living. So all those months when Bryce was alive, I scribbled down notes on index cards with no idea of whether I would ever actually write a story about him. I watched all that went on inside me, how I automatically think that closing down is safe, but that really staying open and loving is safer because then we're connected to all that life and love. And I watched Sam watch Bryce and scribbled some of this down on index cards. I felt self-conscious and vaguely ashamed that so much of what I'd written lately concerned suffering and death, but I let myself take notes anyway. Bryce died that May. A month or so later, I had the opportunity to write a 3-minute essay for a radio show on anything I wanted. And I asked Bryce's parents if it would feel like an invasion of privacy if I wrote about their son. They said no, just the opposite. So I sat down with my index cards, and I looked through the 1-inch picture frame and started writing. Sam saw his first dead person last month. Two friends of ours had a baby who died, and we went to spend the morning with them and the body of their son. He was 5 months old and weighed 8 pounds, down from the 10 he weighed at birth. He wore a white baptismal gown and lay in a big basket on top of his crib, covered with flower petals from the waist down, white as a rose. There were flowers and shrines everywhere, statues of the Buddha and pictures of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, because his mother is a Buddhist, and of Jesus, because his father is a Christian. Bryce looked like a small, concerned angel from someplace snowy. None of us, including Sam, could take our eyes off him. He looked like God. "You what?" my relatives asked when I mentioned this. "You took Sam to see what? As in, what will you take him to see next, brain surgery?" I couldn't explain why I thought it was right, except that I was taught to be terrified of sickness and death, especially early death and also, ironically, aging. And I believe this greatly compromised my life. Of course, I want better for Sam. Lots of my friends have died of cancer and AIDS. But Bryce was the first dead person Sam ever saw. Sam didn't seem scared. Maybe it was because Bryce looked so beautiful in death. He was an old pro at it. He had died during delivery and was resuscitated 7 minutes later, and so was born a second time, but it turned out that he had been gone too long. His eyes were deep gray and always open, and he never cried, or for that matter smiled or even blinked. Bryce's mother's Buddhist friends called him Cloud Boy because he was suspended between heaven and earth, not quite here, not quite there. His father's Christian friends did much of the cooking. Everyone held him and rocked him. Sam and I spent a lot of time reading to him, mostly Dr. Seuss. "He's a good baby," Sam assured Bryce's parents one day. Not knowing how on earth they would take care of him, they had brought Bryce home when he was 3 weeks old, because they didn't want him to die at the hospital. They just wanted him to be home with them and their friends. It was an amazing thing to be a part of. Some people saw Bryce as a tragedy, thought his parents were crazy for not leaving him at the hospital. The rest of us felt incredibly sad, but also that maybe we were in the presence of something holy. Something that didn't have to do with personality or character or age. "He's a good baby," Sam told me one day in the car, after we'd been reading to Bryce for a while. "But he's a little funky." When Bryce died, his parents called us and asked if Sam and I would come over. They were sad, but okay. Sam brought the baby 2 presents that morning, which he laid in the basket. One was a ball, in case you get to play catch on the other side. The other was a small time travel car from Back to the Future. Bryce's parents and I are still scratching our heads over that one. After we left that morning, I took Sam to the local bowling lanes. It was another big first for him. It was all so ridiculous and real that it felt sort of sacred. We bowled in the kids' lane for an hour. "You took him where?" asked my relatives. And I couldn't really explain why. It had something to do with wanting to shake off the solemnity, with wanting to complete the cycle of life and death. Bowling is life at its most immediate. You fling a ball and the pins fall down sometimes. And I also wanted to show Sam that the holy goes on, no matter how many balls you fling at it. I read this to Bryce's parents before I read it on the radio, and then they called everyone they knew and told them when it would be on, and they recorded it. And even though their son will always be alive in their hearts, like Pammy and my dad will be alive in mine, and maybe this is the only way we ever really have anyone, there is still something to be said for painting portraits of the people we have loved, for trying to express those moments that seem so inexpressibly beautiful, the ones that change us and deepen us. Toni Morrison said, "The function of freedom is to free someone else. And if you are no longer racked or in bondage to a person or a way of life, tell your story. Risk freeing someone else. Not everyone will be glad that you did. Members of your family and other critics may wish you had kept your secrets. Oh, well, what are you going to do? Get it all down. Let it pour out of you under the page. Write an incredibly shitty, self-indulgent, whiny, mewling first draft. Then take out as many of the excesses as you can. One thing I haven't told you about my famous short story, Arnold, is that besides sending it off every few months to my father's agent, I also sent it off to an important magazine editor. He sent it back with the following note. You have made the mistake of thinking that everything that has happened to you is interesting. Now, needless to say, I was mortified. But the note ended up only helping me because it didn't stop me. Still, I sat down with great trepidation when I began to write the story of my father's illness because of the mistake this editor said I had made, which I had made. And I tried very hard not to make it again. So, first I wrote down everything that happened to us, and then I took out the parts that felt self-indulgent. I wasn't writing the book with my thumbs stuck out trying to hitchhike into history. I just wanted to write a book for my father that might also help someone going through a similar situation. Some people may have thought that this book was too personal, too confessional. But what these people think about me is none of my business. I got to write books about my father and my best friend, and they got to read them before they died. Can you imagine? I wrote for an audience of two whom I loved and respected, who loved and respected me. So, I wrote for them as carefully and soulfully as I could. Which is, needless to say, how I wish I could write all the time. Finding your voice. I heard a tape once in which an actor talked about trying to find God in the modern world, and how, left to our own devices, we seek instead all the worldly things, possessions, money, looks, and power, because we think they will bring us fulfillment. But this turns out to be a joke, because they're just props, and when we check out of this life, we have to give them all back to the great prop master in the sky. They're just on loan, he said. They're not ours. This tape changed how I felt about my students emulating their favorite writers. It helped me see that it is natural to take on someone else's style, that it's a prop that you use for a while until you have to give it back. And it just might take you to the thing that is not on loan, the thing that is real and true, your own voice. I often ask my students to scribble down in class the reason they want to write. Why they're in my class, what is propelling them to do this sometimes excruciating, sometimes boring work. And over, they say, in effect, I will not be silenced again. They were good children, who often felt invisible, and who saw some awful stuff. But at some point they stopped telling what they saw because when they did, they were punished. Now they want to look at their lives, at life, and they don't want to be sent to their rooms for doing so. But it is very hard to find their own voice, and it is tempting to assume someone else's. Every time Isabel Allende has a new book out, I'm happy because I will get to read it, and I'm unhappy because half of my students are going to start writing like her. Now, I love Miss Allende's work, as I love a number of South and Central American writers. When I read their books, I feel like I'm sitting around a campfire at night where they are spinning their wild stories. These crazy Rube Goldberg clocks with lots of birds and maidens and gongs and bells and whistles. I understand why this style is so attractive to my students. It's like primitive art. It's simple and decorative, with rich colors, satisfying old forms, and a lot of sophistication underneath that you feel but don't really see. I always feel like I'm watching a wild theater piece with lots of special effects, so many lives falling apart. But more important, this style offers the nourishment of imagination and wonder. I love to enter into these fantastical worlds, where we feel like we're looking through the wrong end of the binoculars, where everything is tiny and pretty and rich, because real life is so often big and messy and hurtful and drab. But when someone like Allende polishes and turns and twists her people and their lives and their families and their ghosts into universal curves and shapes, then the writing resonates in such a way that you think, yes, yes, that's exactly what life is like. I love for my students to want to have this effect. But their renditions never ring true, any more than they ring true a few months later when Anne Beattie's latest book arrives and my students start submitting stories about shiny bowls and window panes. We do live our lives on surfaces, And Beatty does surfaces beautifully, burnishing them, bringing out the details. But when my students do Beatty, their stories tend to be lukewarm. And I say to them, life is lukewarm enough. Give us a little heat. If I'm going to read about a bunch of people who drive Volkswagens and seem to have mostly Volkswagen-sized problems, and the writer shows them driving around on top of the ice, I want to sense that there's a lot of very, very cold water down below. I eventually want for someone to crash through. I want people who write to crash or dive below the surface, where life is so cold and confusing and hard to see. I want writers to plunge through the holes we try to fill up with all the props. In those holes and in the spaces around them exist all sorts of possibility, including the chance to see who we are and to glimpse the mystery. The great writers keep writing about the cold, dark place within, the water under a frozen lake, or the secluded, camouflaged hole. The light they shine on this hole, this pit, helps us cut away or step around the brush and brambles. Then we can dance around the rim of the abyss, holler into it, measure it, throw rocks in it, and still not fall in. It can no longer swallow us up, and we can get on with things. A sober friend once said to me, "When I was still drinking, I was a sedated monster. After I got sober, I was just a monster." He told me about his monster. His sounded just like mine, without quite so much mascara. When people shine a little light on their monster, we find out how similar most of our monsters are. The secrecy, the obfuscation, the fact that these monsters can only be hinted at, gives us the sense that they must be very bad indeed. But when people let their monsters out for a little onstage interview, it turns out that we've all done or thought the same things, that this is our lot, our condition. We don't end up with a brand on our forehead. Instead, we compare notes. We write to expose the unexposed. If there is one door in the castle you have been told not to go through, you must. Otherwise, you'll just be rearranging furniture in rooms you've already been in. Most human beings are dedicated to keeping that one door shut. But the writer's job is to see what's behind it, to see the bleak, unspeakable stuff, and to turn the unspeakable into words. Not just into any words, but if we can, into rhythm and blues. You can't do this without discovering your own true voice. And you can't find your true voice and peer behind the door and report honestly and clearly to us if your parents are reading over your shoulder. They're probably the ones who told you not to open that door in the first place. You can tell if they're there because a small voice will say, "Oh, whoops, don't say that. That's a secret." Or, "That's a bad word." Or, "Don't tell anyone you jack off. They'll all start doing it." So you have to breathe or pray or do therapy to send them away. Write as if your parents are dead. As I've said, we will discuss libel later in this book. "Why, though?" my students ask, staring at me intently. "Why are we supposed to open all these doors? Why are we supposed to tell the truth in our own voice?" And I stare back at them for a moment. "I guess because it's our nature," I say. "Also, I think that most of your characters believe, as children believe, that if the truth were known, they would be seen as good people. Truth seems to want expression. Unacknowledged truth saps your energy and keeps you and your characters wired and delusional. But when you open the closet door and let what was inside out, you can get a rush of liberation and even joy. If we can believe the Gnostic gospel of Thomas, old Uncle Jesus said, if you bring forth what is inside you, what you bring forth will save you. If you don't bring forth what is inside you, what you bring forth can destroy you. And the truth of your experience can only come through in your own voice. If it is wrapped in someone else's voice, we readers will feel suspicious, as if you're dressed up in someone else's clothes. You cannot write out of someone else's big, dark place. You can only write out of your own.